Today's world is full of touch technologies. We see it every day. We use it on ATM machines and even in our automobiles. Would you be surprised to know that the very first touch PC came out in 1983? This week's podcast is an interview with Jim Sutton, the leader of the team that introduced touch to the PC marketplace. Enjoy.
This is the Killer Innovations Podcast with Phil McKinney. Keep in mind that the information and opinions expressed in this podcast are Phil's and Phil's alone, and they don't necessarily reflect those of his past, current, or future employers. Now, here's Phil McKinney.
One of the things at HP is we've been focusing a lot most recently on touch, but a lot of people only assume that HP's been working on touch in a fairly recent time frame. Everybody thinks it's new ever since the, you know, iPhone came out and other kinds of touch applications. And what a lot of people don't recognize or don't appreciate was really the history of HP and how HP originally got its part of touch. So Jim, you were involved in the original HP 150 work, which is kind of the iconic PC that really brought touch into the market, but that product came out in 1983. So give me a little bit of background of how you got involved on the HP 150 project and what was your thinking behind the whole touch technology on the 150?
I had joined HP 2 or 3 years before that and was working on small business systems. And in one of HP's perpetual moves, they decided for whatever reasons that small business system deserved to be in Roseville. So the whole system, the whole group picked up and moved to Roseville, except mostly not the people, of course. So the responsibility for the product moved to Roseville. And at that same point in time, we had been doing some looking at PCs. The old, 8080 chips were out before that, and HP actually had a 125 and some other PCs that were based on the, that architecture. So we kind of picked our group up and picked up a few other people and moved across the courtyard here in Cupertino and set up working on the what was originally not going to be a touchscreen PC. And so it was really going to be based on this kind of the same technology as the HP 125, but with the guts pulled out and replaced by an 8086 and 16-bit operating systems and all those exotic things of the time.
So was the original plan, was it a DOS machine? Was the 150 a DOS machine?
No, it was going to be MS-DOS.
Right.
There were rumors at the time in the market about IBM, moving forward with a PC. And so, of course, everyone said, well, there'll be the elephant in the room with which we need to deal. And so we were trying to kind of keep one eye on what IBM was doing and also be creative and innovative with respect to what we were doing and so on. And we arrived at the conclusion that IBM would more than likely choose MS-DOS and that it was probably the better operating system. So we had made a decision to go with MS-DOS at that point in time. In HP's inevitable mechanism was that there were kind of classic power struggles between the divisions or among the divisions as to who would own what set of technology. So at the time, Data Terminals Division, which was a different division, had been working on the touch technology to apply to terminals.
So like VT100 compatible terminals type of things, right? Or terminals going onto the old HP?
The old HP proprietary terminal
mm-hmm.
model.
Mm-hmm.
And so a struggle had happened somewhere else in HP that, was far above my, at the time I think I was a project manager. And so we ended up combining those two groups, and so we said, well, touchscreen technology's here, so let's go with the touchscreen technology, put it into a PC, went with a smaller form factor, because we've been working with a large form factor based on the old HP 125 days, and so we went with the smaller form factor that, of course, was much more like the Mac turned out to be,
mm-hmm.
and, set off using the touch technology in a general purpose PC. Although there still were struggles at the time, as you might imagine, about whether or not this thing should, when you turn it on, what should it be? Should it be a PC or should it be an HP proprietary terminal? And so we ended at kind of a compromise on that, but it still had the HP proprietary terminal built into it. So it turned on as a PC.
But you could put it into terminal mode if you wanted to.
You could put it into terminal mode. And
was that basically to satisfy the internal politics of not wanting to have two different platforms, but the kind of convergence?
Yes, and it was really based a lot, I think, too often, this philosophic moment here, too often I think companies spend too much time listening to their customers. Now, that's a funny thing to say, because I'm actually a person who very much believes in understanding your customers' needs. But I think it's really important to understand what your customers' needs are going to be in the future, as opposed to understanding what your customers' needs are at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So since HP had no PC and there wasn't really a general PC market, I wouldn't put the 125 into a strong player there, or any of the CPM machines. It wasn't just HP. I mean, it was any of the CPM machines. It was hard to envision what that market was going to turn out to be like. But certainly, I had, for example, a very close relationship with Procter & Gamble over years and years of time. And, certainly if you went to Procter & Gamble, what our sales reps were selling into Procter & Gamble were HP 3000s and lots of terminals, okay? And so if you talk to a salesman, their gratification always comes from, what could I sell tomorrow if I had it? And that would be the easiest sale.
Right.
Okay. And so, of course, it's something that will connect to an HP 3000 and be an HP terminal to that HP 3000. And so it was, and I'm not blaming HP, or the salesman or anyone. This is true in any company.
It's even true today. Nothing's changed.
Yeah, I told you a story before we went on tape about the fact that I used to work for IBM Research Labs. And we invented a full-color raster graphic standalone computer, a workstation, if you will, back before Sun or any of the other players in that market had done so. And yet we found the barrier there to be kind of the same, which was the sales reps at IBM were used to going out and selling 3270s customers.
Right. How do I sell this thing?
And so how do I sell this thing? And actually the almost abject terror that it might actually cannibalize 3270 sales.
Well, it's always the challenge with a lot of corporations, right, is this fear of cannibalization. But the realization is if you don't cannibalize your own, somebody else is going to cannibalize you for it anyways. So you looked at the touch technology that was over the data terminal side. Your team made the call about MS-DOS as being the operating system for this. So what was the driver for touch from the standpoint? What were the applications going to be on an HP 150 that were going to really drive the use or the benefit of having a touch technology on it?
Well, I think when, in data terminals, envisioning of this as a terminal,
mm-hmm.
I don't think they thought much about what the technologies would be. I think they thought mostly about the fact that I would essentially have selectable blocks on the screen that mm-hmm. I could poke at. So it's kind of, at the time, I don't know if you recall, but HP products tended to have function keys built across the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And this was seen as a great innovation at the time, at least within HP. I'm not sure if the rest of the world saw it as a great innovation. But in any case, it allowed you to put up, eight blocks across the bottom and I could poke at them, where, essentially invoking a command of some kind. Right, those were done via simple script, so I was literally, poking the button would invoke some little script that I could have typed in mm-hmm. in the same way. But in any case, and I think that was probably the vision within data terminals. Again, nothing mean-spirited about them. That was the world that they came from and how they, envisioned the terminals. So we moved over into what was the data terminals building over on Arquez. And so I think, first of all, I think it was an amazingly creative team, both on the hardware side and on the software side. One of the things I remember about that period of time was that there were only a few kind of old-time HPers that would go into this business. Because I think because it wasn't a comfortable business to be in. Okay, and so we built a team.
So you're talking about the PC business?
Yeah. Not so much the hardware side.
Right.
Okay, the hardware guys were hardware guys and, I'll go solder something together and it'll work. Or put a chip in somewhere, But they were amazingly creative folks that were doing that. And there's a guy named John Lee who was kind of the chief hardware architect on the whole project, was kind of had the glue for putting the whole hardware together. And we came in as a team to basically do the software on the thing. And so as a consequence, it became part of our visioning process, if you will, to say, well, what could the touchscreen be used better for than putting 8 function keys on the bottom of the screen, so to speak. And so we went through and we conceived of a whole series of applications, including the little Rolodex thing that you may have been alluding mm-hmm. to before, and a whole bunch of other things that would use the touch screen in some way. Now, one of these strange little conflicts that you hear about is we wanted to be very generous with our use of graphics and the hardware on the machine. And we were going like this with the terminal, with the hardware guys who were saying, what if I put that much more memory in it, it'll change the price point. And so, you know, for us, it seemed that, and so we talked about when we stored files, that you should automatically be storing them essentially with attributes that would help you in search and retrieval and so on of the files. But, that would take too much space on the disk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so,
right.
So we were in this constant conflict. And, of course, in retrospect, it made no difference because the price of memory and disks and so on were dropping so fast that it probably would have been a better solution to have gone ahead and done some things that we weren't able to do because we couldn't resolve that conflict in our favor, so to speak.
Right.
When I say our here, I'm talking about software versus,
right.
versus hardware.
The hardware guys versus the price point that the sales and marketing team guys had the price point. What did the 150 sell for when it first came out?
Oh, gee. I don't remember. I mean, it was fantastically expensive by today's things, but I don't remember the actual price point. I do remember, though, that Bob Puett was the general manager of that division. And so I spent a lot of time on tour with Bob prior to introduction and so on. And kind of we were trying to ramp up a dealer network and as well as direct sales network and
right.
so on. And you go talk to the, it was funny, you go talk to the dealer, Cyril Yansuni, I don't know if you've come across Cyril, he was kind of Bob's boss in all of this, so he was the group general manager. And he was on many of these tours too. The dealers were just wildly excited by this. So, you know, every day at the end of the day, Cyril or Bob would phone back home and say, up the production plans! So the dealers did actually see it as an attractive price point. I mean, there are some other reasons why some of those, a lot of those predictions didn't turn out to be true, but had to do less with the touchscreen than the fact that at that point in time, the IBM PC had come out and really established itself in the market, and it turned out that compatibility with the IBM PC meant a lot more than having chosen the right operating system.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, because you guys were developing the 150 almost simultaneously with IBM's introduction, and then you also had Apple coming out with the original Mac
mm-hmm.
kind of in that same time window. So you had kind of this perfect, or you could refer to it as the imperfect storm of innovation, all
right.
occurring all within kind of an 18-month period between the 150 coming out, the IBM PC coming out, and then Apple coming out with the original Mac. And so what you're saying really is this drive towards the being compatible, not just with the operating system, but getting down into the whole BIOS issues and
yep.
the launch of companies like Compaq, where they reverse engineered the BIOS in order to drive their compatibility to be able to run those applications. Because part of the challenge with the 150, I'm guessing, is you also had to go out and get the ecosystem of application developers to write those applications for touch.
Yeah, and initially that was not a difficult problem. Okay, because although they didn't use touch well, because, I mean, obviously Lotus, if they've got something for the, or VisiCalc even at that point in time, if they've got something for the IBM PC, they're not going to put a lot of effort into customizing it to mm-hmm. run on the on HP Iron. So that was probably part of the genesis of why we decided to put together this kind of core set of, if you will, small applications. And try to really be more creative about using touch. So having a Rolodex that you could spin on the screen by touch, or having, the general notion was that you take a 3D object that people would be familiar with in their everyday life, business people would be familiar with, say it's a Rolodex or any other kinds of things like that, Okay, and then you say, okay, if we transported that object into a 2D representation, how could we manipulate that object on the screen? And also, what other than features could we naturally use within it? So, for example, the Rolodex became a mini database system with some of the, you know,
right,
aspects of what you could do in a database.
So there was, so the team on the 150, you guys were actually doing that kind of 3D to 2D representation and that manipulation. And HP actually had some of the original, some of the early original patents in that space.
Yeah, the group that I had did hold the patent, and it was a very broad patent in touch manipulation of 2D representations of 3D objects. That patent has expired because it would certainly cover the iPod and the iPhone and the...
Right, but wasn't there some kind of a litigation situation that happened with Apple on those patents?
There was, but it wasn't with the patents. It was with the interface itself. Okay, and it actually came along a bit later when we got into on Vectras into the new wave business. And so we created, there our vision was we wanted a very object-oriented interface. So we created a set of applications at the time where many years before Microsoft did the same thing, of where you could have a, you know, a document fully formatted and have a jet fighter flying through the, you know, mm-hmm, in a window with a frame within the document doing loops or whatever else. So you could have a video object within a text object, you know, document, mm-hmm, object, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that was really what we got sued about by Apple, who wanted to claim that we were infringing on their interface, which, of course, really wasn't patented. And the real truth is, of course, is that Apple had been infringing on Xerox's interface, if you wanted to look at it that way,
right,
from well before.
What was the outcome of that suit?
We won the suit, so it was not a... It turned out...
So Apple sued, and we won the suit.
Yeah, Apple sued, we won. Okay. So, and to be frank, I mean, I think what we were doing was, at the time, was much more advanced than what Apple was doing on the Mac.
You look at any company, whether it's HP or a lot of, you know, the leading tech companies that have survived over multiple decades, is if you see these areas where a company really advances technology. So, you know, in this case, in the new wave activities and the UIs and that whole object experience, but is unable to capitalize on that. You know, and it's, in many cases, I would argue that companies have a hard time with timing. We way out ahead of the market. We invest to a certain point, and if there isn't immediate reaction from the market, management then goes off in other directions. So, give me your thoughts about, you know, you think about things like that that HP was not able to capitalize on. What do you think was the barrier for HP to go off and do those kinds of things, since they were ahead of more doing more advanced work than what Apple's doing? They were way ahead of Microsoft. Why was HP unable to capitalize on that?
I think there were a number of reasons, but you can see this in any company, and I don't know whether HP, you know, still struggles with this or not, but at the time is that HP really was not a software company. And so, you know, when we did New Wave, for example, I was kind of the original envisioner, if you will, and proselytizer of that. And the way that all came about was, you know, I actually kind of in the back door finagled some resources out of the graphic arts group that we had just within our division. And so I got a whole bunch of kind of first just slides on, you know, on foils, if you remember the old technology, to use the IBM term, foils, okay? And they were of what the screens would look like. And we had, you know, like 100 slides or something that you could run through and say you'd be here and you'd do this and, you know, then you'd see the jet fighter flying through the document and you'd, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so I would say HP had no natural predilection to try to do something like New Wave. But it was really through a matter of just, you know, personal selling originally and then a small group of us selling and going out and proselytizing with management at all levels in HP and really selling them on the notion that this was, you know, that we could really make a differentiator. But I think it was still very difficult for HP in the end to say, well, wait a minute, how does this help me sell hardware?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to being in the software business.
So, you know, we talked before about, you know, some of the early work that you were involved in, both on the patents for 2D representation of 3D objects and New Wave and kind of the precursors of what we all experience today.
Yes.
What do you think, do you have kind of a view of where you think the technology curve is going today? I mean, you're still active in the space, you're still involved in technologies, but, you know, what do you think the next 5 years are going to look like?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, clearly to me, as we'd mentioned before we went on tape, so to speak, you know, I'm involved in internet publishing kinds of things now. And as I get more and more involved in that and in the in understanding how that works, I mean, to me, a lot of the things that should be no surprise are almost around the corner. It's not 5 years out. But mm-hmm. it's, I mean, you know, the cloud computing, the social networking things as being kind of a fundamental part of what happens. For example, I also own a retail store, internet retail store, and the, you know, suddenly I couldn't process credit cards. Why not? You know, what's going on? Look around the internet. How do I find out? You know, I go to Twitter. And, you know, that's how I discover that there was a major fire in my credit card processor's building. Okay. And so, I mean, a lot's going to, change, I think, with the social media kinds of things. You know, in computing itself, I mean, to me, it just is patently obvious that there's going to be this convergence. I mean, if you take the iPhone, for example, I mean, look at how popular the iPhone is and kind of what it does and those kinds of things. To me, there's going to be a convergence, clearly, between laptops and iPhones, mm-hmm. so to speak. Okay.
Yeah, the mobility factor is becoming more and more important.
Right. And that the kinds of interfaces that you have on the iPhone and so on will be ubiquitous everywhere. You know, and those will continue to evolve over time. But, I mean, somehow in my future, I see that I kind of have a series, maybe two devices or something, but that at one level, they like the iPhone does now, and I do this on it, but I can kind of, if you will, connect things into it, either logically or physically, such that I, so my whole computing needs are essentially solved through that.
So you've had a pretty interesting career. So you came from IBM Research, came to HP, involved in a variety of things, went on to Informix and other tech companies. You know, one of the core group of listeners to the podcast are kids that are in high school and college thinking about getting, you know, the innovation buzz is out there. They've been bitten by the bug. You know, they want to be able to go create new things. And one of the common questions I get from listeners is, you know, what's the best way I can prepare myself? If, you know, I'm a high school kid getting ready to go into college, or I'm finishing my bachelor's degree, do I go for an MBA? Do I go get work career experience? So if you're sitting in front of a young person thinking about going into wanting to be an engineer or an innovator, you know, what career advice would you give them?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's any one size fits all here. So a variety of ways. My particular background is engineering and business. So, you know, kind of schooling in both. Now, I will mostly say that my business degrees are actually not practical to anything. I mean, they don't, you know, when you take business, it doesn't tell you that how to work backwards to figure out how you're going to make a profit out of, you know, what percentage of every dollar is going here, there, or whatever. So those are things you just have to kind of learn through skill. But I do think that having a business background allows you to think of things in kind of a different framework.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But not everyone has to have a business degree. I think you can do fine with engineering. We used to do a lot of... one thing when we were working on the HP 150, and I think I touched on this before, but I don't know, is that since we only had a few people kind of from the traditional HP that would follow us into this environment of the brave new world, is we did a lot of fresh out of college hiring. And since we were always seemed to be over-constrained on the number of recs we did a lot of stuff with students. So we would bring students in to spend 6 months with us.
The internship programs.
Yeah, the internship programs. And, I mean, there's a couple comments to make about that. One is this was an incredibly satisfying and fun time in life, not only for the students, but for everyone involved in the process. I mean, we still get together and drink beer or, you know, do other things, from, you know, 20 some years later, 25 years later, whatever it is, out of doing this, because it was such a bonding experience, I think, out of the whole thing. But also, you know, and this is one of the things I think is important toward, I don't know if it's still in the HP culture, perhaps it is, it certainly was at the time, kind of, you know, one embodiment of the HP way was, is that you gave people massive amounts of responsibility and then held them responsible for what they were doing. So we had, for example, for their kind of low-level and high-level graphics that we had to do on the HP 150, and we just didn't have resources to do those. So we brought two students in, and we gave one student the low-level and one student the high-level, two young ladies, and they just did wonderful jobs on them. And, you know, one of them's a general manager or VP or whatever up at Microsoft now. Okay. Out of doing that. So I would think that a lot of the, you know, that those kinds of programs, those interning kinds of programs in, especially if you can get into a creative group in doing those, are very important to kind of developing how you approach things. You know, and the other thing is just a more general comment, when I've used this phrase before, which is, you know, I think you should always be looking at what I'll call an imagine, and I'm not the inventor of this phrase either, but an imaginative understanding of users' needs. Okay, so what that means is you don't ask them what they want. I mean, you do that. But then after they tell you, you say, well, where is the world going to be a year from now, 2 years, 3 years from now? So what happens if I take these needs and I translate them into that time frame? How will it be different?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all those were important, I think.
Common thing we hear, we come across a lot of innovators who have been part of really kind of breakthrough products, something that really was ahead of the marketplace and really kind of showed thought leadership. This is kind of that experience of breaking new ground and the bonds that are created with that team, but also the once you've had the taste of that, when you've created that team and you deliver that product, this chase to go do it again.
Yes.
And to go do it again.
Yep.
And the frustration when you don't, sometimes, you know, repeating it someplace else or even in the same company is very hard to do. So thoughts on, you know, that transition, once you've done the 150 or New Wave, those kinds of bonding experiences, what was some of the impact on you and team members? And
well, certainly, the bonding, I would agree that just being in that kind of environment creates the bonding experience. You know, assuming you don't blow the team up in the first place. I mean, you can have an unsuccessful team,
mm-hmm.
you know, just for team reasons, independent of what you're working on. But I mean, I think in this case that we were, you know, we were all very close, you know, it was, I mean, probably 3/4 of the people in the team were 23 or 24 years old. So they were, you know, very young. They, by and large, were not married. So and almost the team almost became their family. You know, because they'd move from colleges all across the country and so on. I don't think that's a necessary component, but it was certainly a nice component in this, you know, in this sense to bring that together. And I've always really, I really value that kind of, you know, team bonding thing. And I think it goes a long ways toward creativity, because when you give people the, you know, what we all tried to do, I think, was just create the atmosphere, the vision of where it is that we're trying to go. So when everyone's bought into that vision, and it's a loose vision, it's not down to the detail, but it's the loose vision of where you're trying to go, then everyone becomes a contributor to, you know, to what you're doing in that vision. So, I don't know, it's a fun experience. I think it can be frustrating in going to, you know, other environments where maybe because of what your objectives are for the company or whatever, you don't have that opportunity to be creative or as creative again. But I mean, you can be creative in any situation, but the question is it a big lump creative or is it?
Yeah, and I think it's also this issue of, you know, you talk to people who were involved in something, you know, what they classify as pretty significant in their career in that really tight team bonding exercise. And then when you talk to them, you know, after they've gone off and done other things, the one thing they comment about is kind of almost a longing for that experience to happen, you know, yeah, once again.
I would say that's true with me too, which is, I've had two or three of those experiences in my life, and I certainly look back at those as, you know, with very fond memories.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we were working at that point in time probably, you know, 12 hours a day or more, or 6 days a week or something, but nonetheless, kind of the intensity of the whole situation does create a very, you know, satisfying and intense situation.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. To augment what you've just heard, we've produced a two-disc, two-hour CD called Creating Killer Innovations. The CD covers such topics as the management of innovation, the skills of innovation, and the killer innovation methodology. The CD is available on Amazon or at philmckinney.com. For feedback to today's show, please send an email to podcast@killerinnovations.com. For more information or to connect via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or to connect to the broader community of listeners to the podcast, visit philmckinney.com. Again, thanks for listening to today's podcast. I truly do appreciate the time out of your busy schedule, and we'll talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.
This series of interviews with innovation thought leaders is made possible by support from thenextbench.com. For more information on the series and to listen to the previous episodes, visit thenextbench.com.